Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the scorching criticism of Trump and his family by Steve Bannon in a new book that has provoked an angry and dismissive response from Donald Trump, who goes so far as to say Bannon has lost his mind. David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he has an article, Why Trump Turned on Steve Bannon, joins us to discuss the growing number of top senior officials from the Trump campaign and the Trump White House who, after being indicted, charged, or fired, suddenly become junior, insignificant nobodies. We'll assess how much Trump's fury at Bannon was aroused by his former chief White House strategist and campaign CEO's criticism of Ivanka, Jared Kushner, and Donald Jr., not to mention Bannon's portrait of a leader of the free world who is out of touch, borderline illiterate, disrespected by his own close advisers, and apparently horrified that he won the election. Then we'll look further into the vengeful and petty man in the Oval Office and how much he operates out of his mentor Roy Cohn's playbook, and speak with Andy Wright, a professor at Savannah Law School who served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. He joins us to discuss Trump's war on the Department of Justice and his efforts in conjunction with the White House propaganda arm, Fox News, to discredit the FBI and the Mueller investigation, as well as the Republican cover-up underway of the 21 hours of testimony to three Republican-controlled committees by the heads of Fusion GPS, which refutes the White House and Fox's case against Mueller and the FBI inquiry into Trump and the Russians. Then finally, we will speak with Pakistan's former ambassador to the United States, Hussein Haqqani, about Trump's threatening tweets accusing Pakistan of giving the U.S. in exchange for $33 billion in aid, quote, nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools. We'll examine this souring relationship from the inside and analyze the differing strategic goals of the U.S. and Pakistan, as well as the growing importance of China's role in investment and infrastructure in Pakistan. And joining us now are David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Why Trump Turned on Steve Bannon. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Graham.
Thank you for having me.
And it is pretty extraordinary, the fury with which Donald Trump turned on Steve Bannon today in a statement that was pretty scorching. It went so far as to suggest that Steve Bannon has lost his mind. That's pretty unusual for even a president. I mean, everything that Trump has done has been unusual for a president, that's for sure. But this is somebody that he, like all of the people that have been fired, indicted, or charged, these top officials, they all suddenly become insignificant nobodies.
Right. This is such a pattern. He was just a guy who worked for me. He was briefly a volunteer on the campaign. This is what he said about Bannon. It's what he said about George Papadopoulos. It's what he said about Paul Manafort. And what he said about Michael Flynn too, over and over again, when these guys get in trouble or when they become annoyance to him, he says they're sort of they're minor bit players, although never with quite the fury that this statement about Bannon offers.
So what do you think is the reason for this anger, apart from the obvious fact that Bannon has talked rather out of school with a reporter who apparently was invited into the White House and now has a book, a tell-all book? Nobody's questioning the veracity of what Michael Wolff is reporting, are they?
I think so. I've seen some people with some questions about it. And, Wolff has done books like this before. He does these dishy books, and he often reconstructs these scenes. And sometimes there are doubts about, how creative he is in the reconstruction. Generally, though, my impression is that his reporting on past books, including a big one about Rupert Murdoch, has tended to hold up.
So the portrait of Trump and his administration, I mean, the book's not out yet, but I think pretty large excerpts. New York Magazine has large excerpts. The Guardian, I've got a copy. What we've learned so far is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, it's more damning than most of what we've heard so far. And the fact that Bannon has always been seen as being somebody that was close to Trump, it carries more weight. So I can see why Trump is angry.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of fascinating things in here. The New York Mag excerpt, you know, talks about how no one on the campaign apparently expected to win on election night, which a few people had gotten that, but nowhere in as much detail. And it talks about Trump talking on the phone, not wanting to work in office, not really digesting his briefing materials, not being focused on things. We have yet again examples of his aides treating him really like a child and with a great deal of disrespect. Plus, then you have Bannon saying that the Trump Tower meeting in June 2016 was treasonous and unpatriotic. And you have him going after not only Jared Kushner, a longtime nemesis, but also after Donald Trump Jr. And that seems to have really crossed a line for the White House.
Well, also Ivanka, he's saying that Ivanka has pretensions to becoming the first female president of the United States.
Right. There's really a lot of grandiosity involved here.
Well, again, I don't know that if this stuff is not accurate, then you would think the president would have said something, but he hasn't. He's just sort of turned the tables and done another character assassination, Bannon.
Yeah, we haven't seen any really detailed rebuttal of any of the stuff in the story yet. We'll see if it comes, but so far I haven't seen much.
And again, I'm speaking with David Graham, a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National. And he has an article at The Atlantic, Why Trump Turned on Steve Bannon. So in terms of the record here, you mentioned a few of them that are Papadopoulos and Manafort. Suddenly, you know, Manafort goes from being the head of the campaign to some guy that sort of we hired along the way. Whose name I don't remember. The most outrageous of all, of course, was the national security advisor, who was also very close to Trump on the campaign. He was one of the few people that Trump sort of brought out on his rallies, General Flynn. When he was finally, well, after he was fired, Trump's lawyer, Ty Cobb, dismissed Flynn as a former Obama administration official. Without the caveat that one of the few things that happened in that meeting, apparently, between Trump and Obama, where there was a moment of cordiality, apparently Obama had strenuously urged Trump not to hire General Flynn as his national security advisor, as had Trump's friend, Governor Chris Christie. So, but then suddenly he becomes an Obama holdover, right? Just because he was the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who, by the way, Obama fired him, didn't he, from the DIA?
Right, exactly. It's really audacious to try to paint him as an Obama guy.
Right. So what does this tell us about Trump, do you think, in terms of this idea that, I mean, the cumulative effect of all this surely has to raise the question in most people's minds that how come Trump hired these people if they're such nobodies?
Exactly. I think that's exactly the question it raises. You know, to a certain extent, you can distance yourself from the odd rogue staffer, but when you have this many people who are either have, you know, pleaded guilty to felonies or who are accused of felonies or who are out saying that, you know, you can't absorb material and you're a narcissist and so on, it raises questions about your hiring process. Trump obviously came out saying he hired the best people, but time and again he's had to jettison people either because they have caused him problems or they have criticized him or they've gotten in trouble with the law. And at some point, you know, I think the pattern is clear and the pattern is really questionable hires. We haven't even talked about some of the other people who have come and gone, you know, people like Sebastian Gorka, for example. You know, there's a long list of these people who they've shipped out or who have decided to quit because of the stresses of the administration.
So Trump, though, has exhibited earlier signs of pique at anybody that gets too much credit. And that happened, right, in the New York Times interview in November of 2016, apparently, where Trump said, I'm the one who makes the decisions, right? That happened after Steve Bannon landed on the cover of Time magazine, right, which apparently is a big deal to Trump. And as we know, he made a sort of preemptive dismissal of Time magazine, saying he didn't want to be on the cover this year in advance of the fact that he wasn't on the cover, right?
Right. There's this, the real, you know, concern that anything might undermine the legitimacy of his victory, whether that's credit going to Steve Bannon or credit going to the Russians. All of these things really get under his skin.
So Steve Bannon was the CEO of the campaign, an unusual title in itself, but he succeeded effectively Paul Manafort, another nobody in retrospect now, who, by the way, Manafort has just sued the DOJ and special counsel Robert Mueller along with Rob Rosenstein. But I don't know that the suit has a lot of merit. Are you aware of that, David?
Yeah, I've seen the suit briefly. You know, the DOJ dismissed it out of hand.
Right.
You know, it's. I guess all of this is sort of uncharted territory, but it doesn't seem immediately like a promising avenue for him.
But after being with the campaign, and I don't know how the credit is dispersed, but it's pretty clear that Bannon had a significant role, right? Not the least of which was the digital stuff that they did, while Hillary spent all that money on traditional television advertising. And after that, he landed a job as chief strategist, which is another unusual title, but nevertheless a pretty prominent one. And you see him in all those early pictures, right, in all of those meetings. So he wasn't the nobody that they're trying to portray, surely.
That's right. I mean, he was very important to the campaign. And he joined the campaign when Trump was flailing. You know, he was down double digits. No one was giving him any chance at winning. I think the question of how much credit Bannon deserves is an open one, because although he was not a nobody, he was also very good at cultivating press credit and very good at talking to the press behind the scenes and making his role look big. So, you know, it's plausible that Bannon got more credit than he deserved, but it's also not plausible that he was a nobody in the way that Trump is painting him now.
So what is it about Bannon then and the press? I mean, in fact, in this, you know, response to Bannon today from the White House, I don't know whether you suspect it wasn't written by Trump, right?
It doesn't read like the way he would write. Right. It seems like somebody must have written it for him, yeah.
Right. But basically he said, Steve pretends to be at war with the media, which he calls the opposition party, yet he spent his time in the White House leaking false information to the media to make himself seem far more important than he was. He certainly did do a pretty amazing leak to Bob Kuttner, the editor of the American Prospect, and that was the reason, at least nominally used, to explain why he was fired. That was a pretty amazing interview in itself, some of the stuff that he said. Certainly undercut the policy on North Korea, where he said, you know, the North Koreans have got us, there's nothing we can do, while the White House is out there trying to suggest that there's a military option that's viable. That was pretty stunning. But this stuff from Michael Wolff's new book is even more stunning, isn't it? So what is it about Bannon, apart from the fact that he's apparently incredibly indiscreet and reckless?
I think there's a couple things with him. One is he, as a media executive himself, really, I think, does believe in the power of the press. And one reason he attacks the press so much is he thinks it's very important. And he's seen how he can marshal Breitbart to get things done. I also think he's in the long tradition of people who get into the White House and into politics and think that they are much more clever than the press, and they can spin the press. And often that works for a while. I mean, I think Bannon's reputation as a sort of shadowy genius is in part due to his willingness to talk to reporters. But eventually that can cause trouble. And I think his talking to the press helped get him fired, and now you see him on the outs with Trump. We'll see how his reputation fares in the long term.
But he went to great lengths when he was fired. Bannon went to great lengths to suggest that he was still close to Trump. They talked regularly on the phone, and that his entire strategy outside of the White House was to help Trump. Obviously, that's not happening now, right? I mean,
well, if you look at something like the Roy Moore race, you know, Trump backs Luther Strange, and Bannon backs Roy Moore, but what he says is, well, Roy Moore is really the candidate who is closer to Trumpist principles. Trump has been captured by Mitch McConnell, but really Roy Moore is the Trumpist candidate. So Bannon spins these things as defending, if not the actual positions that Trump is taking, the principles that he thinks the Trump presidency represents, which is to say the principles that he wanted the Trump presidency to represent.
Well, but Trump did end up supporting Roy Moore and not campaigning for him actively in the state, but doing everything short of that.
Right, and then exactly. Well, so Trump, you know, backs Strange, and then eventually comes around to Moore, and then today in his statement accuses Bannon of losing the Alabama seat, even though Trump eventually also ended up backing Roy Moore. So he's trying to have both sides of it.
So what do you think is this a new battle line between, is Bannon going to assume the mantle of the base? All we hear every day on cable TV in the coverage of the Trump administration is that all Trump cares about is the base, and everything he does is designed to appeal to them. You can't have two people appealing to the base, right?
I think it's a real test. I mean, you know, there was a time when Breitbart was very important for driving up Trump's support when he was a candidate. And I think Bannon believes that Breitbart still has that sway. Trump believes that the base is now loyal to him, shrinking though it may be, and not to Breitbart. And I think we'll find out very soon. You know, you can dip into places like Reddit immediately, and you see people drawing up the battle line saying, oh, you know, Bannon has betrayed this, we're on Trump's side, or vice versa. You know, one suspects that Breitbart's reach is not as great as it has been made out to be, and we will see that soon. But perhaps it will be, and perhaps a lot of people will stick to the Bannon side of things and think that Trump has betrayed them on immigration and a range of other issues, and he's no longer worth their support.
Well, just in closing, though, it would seem that some of what Bannon said in this new book, particularly about that White House meeting in June with the Russians, he claims that after the meeting with Don Jr., Manafort, and Jared, the Russians were walked up one flight of stairs, walked up one floor to meet with Trump. So that puts Trump right in the middle of the Mueller investigation.
It does, and I take that with a little bit of grain of salt. You know, it's Bannon speculating that he thinks that they must have gone to talk to Trump, but he doesn't claim to have direct knowledge. But if true, that would obviously be a huge deal.
Well, what can I say? What can anybody say? It's so hard to keep up with him. You know, yesterday I did a piece on the Korea, and before I got off the air, Trump had tweeted out that his nuclear button is bigger than the North Korean guy's nuclear button. So every day it's extraordinary. And maybe is that Trump's method to his madness? He keeps distracting us all the time.
I don't know how much he's trying to distract, but I think trying to just keep things going and keep the excitement moving is his classic salesmanship technique and his TV technique, and so that's what he goes with.
Well, David Graham, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Graham, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers political and global news. He previously reported for Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, and The National, and he has an article at The Atlantic, Why Trump Turned on Steve Bannon. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how much Trump operates out of his mentor Roy Cohn's playbook.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair.
You can't hide your lying eyes and your smile's a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no way to hide your lying eyes.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andy Wright, a professor at Savannah Law School, who teaches constitutional law, criminal procedure, presidential powers, and federal criminal law. Previously, he served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Wright.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And do you think that there's an attempt on the part of the president to purge the Justice Department and certainly the FBI, since he's been attacking the FBI for some time? But just yesterday, he attacked the Justice Department, called it the Deep State Justice Department. That presumably, how much is that a declaration of war?
I think it's quite significant as a declaration of hostilities between the president and his own administration. I've never seen anything like it. There were some parallels in the Nixon White House, but this is worse because the president is actively campaigning against the career prosecutors and law enforcement officials who serve under both parties, whoever's elected by the American people. And, you know, it's absolutely critical that we have confidence in the job that they do. It's hard for them when there are politically charged investigations to fly right and navigate the storms of, you know, members of Congress and others who have political interests. But when the president of the United States has taken a position where he is both claiming an absolute legal right to control their conduct and hire and fire them at will, notwithstanding the civil service protections that we have in place to protect their job security from that kind of political attack, but then at the same time turning around and acting as, you know, sort of a chief critic of the people who beneath him are trying to carry out the constitutional mandate to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The president has that obligation personally, both as a matter of his oath and as a matter of a constitutional obligation. And in the context of the Justice Department, that means he's supposed to be hands off. His obligation is not to control it, is to sit back and let people follow the law and the facts wherever they lead. I used to be one of the White House lawyers, one of the few people who's designated with the authority to speak to the Justice Department. And even then, it was very circumscribed. It was monitored, usually went up the chain to, you know, the White House counsel, over to the White House counsel, to the Deputy Attorney General or Attorney General, and then back down if you needed to get information for some other function that the president needed to perform, let's say a pardon or something else where he has a constitutional role. You know, the idea is to not have the White House calling willy-nilly over to influence lying prosecutors or lying FBI agents, and this president is sitting there with his Twitter button and just going nuts on people who are really trying to do their jobs and keep all of us with some modicum of confidence that law enforcement will be even-handed.
But there's been a deafening silence from the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. What do you make of that?
Well, I think, you know, I saw that Eric Holder and other former senior Justice Department officials of both parties have been critical of Sessions and the FBI director, Wray, for not taking a stronger public stance to defend their workforce from the president's attacks. I understand that they're in a really tough position, but it would send a really important message to the line prosecutors and line FBI agents out there in the field working hard every day and risking their lives if their leadership publicly, you know, created the insulation they need to do their job without interference from the president of the United States.
So what's going on here in the broadest sense then, when you've got Fox News, and we know that Trump is in regular contact with Rupert Murdoch, who's some kind of a political mentor, it seems. They've launched a prolonged and vicious attack against the FBI, and particularly against an FBI agent, Strzok, who tweeted out some critical comments about Trump, but he also tweeted out a lot of critical comments about Hillary Clinton, about Bernie Sanders, about Martin O'Malley. And he reflects what I think is the culture inside the FBI and to some extent the Justice Department, is that they are apolitical and they don't particularly hold politicians in great esteem. And yet they're trying to politicize this by suggesting somehow the FBI are full of Clinton people and, you know, closet Democrats or whatever. So that's been underway. And then they've also been using Fox. Or Fox is, who knows whether it's the chicken and the egg, whether it's Fox and the White House, but there's some kind of compact there. They've also attacking ruthlessly and viciously Mueller, the special prosecutor, this former judge, Jean Pirro, whose husband was nabbed by the FBI, has got some vendetta against the FBI. She's going after both Mueller and the idea that the FBI are a bunch of Democratic political hacks. My understanding, if you polled the FBI, you'd find out that most of them probably vote Republican. But what's going on here? I mean, what do you make of this campaign to discredit Mueller and to suggest that the FBI is a biased organization and by extension, the Justice Department needs to be purged?
Sure. Well, you know, the American constitutional government is a stakeholder model, not a command and control model. I mean, outside of the military, the chain of command is a little bit more diffuse in our government, and you have to negotiate with members of Congress, and you have federal civil service laws, et cetera. President Trump's model is to attack any institution that stands in his way, whether that's a member of Congress or a so-called judge or you know, you name it. And here he's got an FBI that is doing its job, which, and in, you know, their proper conception of their job is to have some independence from the president. They're not his henchmen. They're following the law and the facts under the United States Code. And he can't have, he can't seem to stand for that kind of independence anywhere in his government. He wants absolute loyalty. And so between Fox News and the president, they're trying to grind and attack any institution that provides even the most modest bit of resistance. The idea that the FBI is a big Democratic partisan, you know, organization is laughable. And if you, you know, especially I'm sure Hillary Clinton's staff would feel that they certainly didn't have a lot of fans, especially in the New York field office during the 2016 campaign. I think, you know, I think people can be partisan. They're Americans. They can have political views, even if they're in a job that calls for professionalism and nonpartisan application of the law. And I think the FBI does that very well. You know, the fact that if there are people who are demonstrating too much bias against someone who might be a target of an investigation, like in this case, the president, I think it's important to make sure that they are removed. Again, the goal here is to make sure that the American people have confidence in the system. My understanding is that Robert Mueller did that with when he got some signs that there might be an appearance problem with certain agents on his staff. He removed them from a position of responsibility pending further inquiry by the appropriate inspector general or officer of professional responsibility. So to my mind, the biggest key is to hold the rule of law here, and the rule of law requires that we have some confidence in the system, and I think it's a shame that there is a calculated campaign trying to spear Mueller. Now, the campaign won't do much to the courtroom. You know, Article III life tenure judges are going to be hearing what's presented from grand juries and prosecutors and indictments and conducting over proceedings in a normal course. But to the extent that this is an investigation that also has a political component, a legitimate one, in that Congress is looking at what happened in the Russia investigation and has to undertake further policy measures to protect us from attacks by foreign adversaries, and are also ultimately the ones that have to decide whether there are going to be political repercussions for particular government officials, up to and including impeachment, then this strategy of the president with Fox News is going to have some effect. If he can carry 40 or 50% of the Republican base thinking that there's nothing to this, this is a witch hunt, and that Mueller is a partisan hack when he's not, that's going to freeze Republican leaders from taking the kind of aggressive investigative activities that public policy calls for. So in that sense, it really could have some damaging effects. And it also may pave the way for the president ultimately to try and have Mueller removed, although that would be a seismic event, I think, even larger than former FBI Director Comey's firing.
And again, I'm speaking with Andy Wright, who's a professor at Savannah Law School, who teaches constitutional law, criminal procedure, presidential powers, and federal criminal law. Previously, he served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. Well, in many ways, it does seem that the ghost of Roy Cohn inhabits the Oval Office, because there's a sort of viciousness and vindictiveness to much of what Donald Trump's agenda has been. He has some obsession to undo all that Barack Obama achieved. But there's also, when you look at all the people that, you know, his national security advisor, which is an extremely important top job in an administration, he's already basically flipped and is cooperating with the special counsel. Manafort, his campaign manager, is also obviously in the crosshairs and has been indicted and looks like he's got a huge problem facing him. And in general, you've got one of his former lieutenants who is credited with helping the campaign once it crashed and burned after Manafort was fired. Stephen Bannon is now talking to an author, an explosive book that is all over the news today, really saying the most caustic attacks on Trump and his family and the whole operation. So this is an extraordinary situation, isn't it? I mean, for the life of me, I don't understand why the Republicans and the Republican Party are so zealously standing by Trump when you know, the people closest to him are either being indicted, under investigation, or stabbing him in the back and gossiping in the most damaging way.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a combination of cynicism and fear that are freezing Republican leaders like Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan from undertaking their constitutional obligations to hold the president accountable. And, you know, it's shocking. The national security advisor of the president has, pled to a crime and is cooperating with a federal prosecutor. His former campaign chairman is under indictment. He's got other campaign aides who are cooperating and have pled guilty to crimes based on their associations with Russia. And we've got the president's, Svengali, supposedly Steve Bannon, now saying that the president engaged in a treasonous meeting. He's using the word treason, even though that's not legally applicable, but it's politically explosive for sure, and the president firing back. And we've got the leadership in the Republican Party and in Congress sitting by on their hands. So I think, they're gonna, without a profile and courage here, they're gonna continue to hold this weird tightrope where they don't want to deal with the president's serious misconduct allegations, and they're going to try and stick their heads in the sand like an ostrich until they can't. Now, if the president's approval ratings remain in the ditch in the 30s, as we get deeper into an election year, we may see them try to position themselves with some more daylight. But right now, they're still acting in a way that shows fear. And you mentioned Roy Cohn. And the McCarthy hearings and the Red Scare. And the big question in the Republican Party is who's going to be the Joseph Welch of the Republican Party? Who's going to stand up and say, have you no shame? And so far, we have not seen that person arise. The people who have shown some resistance, like Jeff Flake, are exiting the stage. What we need are some people with a future in the Republican Party to decide that they're going to stand up and be counted.
Well, you have to add to that, though, the op-ed in today's New York Times by the heads of Fusion GPS, the people that generated the Steele dossier. They've given 21 hours of testimony to the Senate and House Intelligence Committee's investigations and the Judiciary Committee investigation in the Senate. And all of this stuff has been leaked to far-right Breitbart and Fox outlets, trying to discredit Steele and Fusion GPS. And these two guys have had to go public, their former Wall Street Journal reporters, and basically say, look, they didn't say exactly what they said over 21 hours, but they gave some extraordinary pieces of information about what they had told the Senate and these committees, and clearly the Republicans are sitting on this material. They don't want the public to know what this inquiry, they basically went after these guys and they defended themselves, and the evidence that they provided apparently exonerates them and is extremely damaging to Trump and really puts more context and explanation into this tangled web of the Russia story, and they're sitting on it. So is it the calculus that, well, we can hopefully ride this out to the 2018 elections and keep the big shoe from dropping? Because, frankly, Donald Trump is not behaving like an innocent man. An innocent man would want to clear his name, would want to make sure that the world knew that his election was free and fair and that he's a legitimate president and that there's no taint of foreign interference. And yet he's doing everything that would indicate that he's a guilty man. He's attacking his accusers. But the part of it that's extraordinary is the extent to which the Republican Party is going along with the cover-up, not only going along with the cover-up, but actively engaged in the cover-up.
Yeah, the Chairman Grassley and Chairman Nunez, who's reassuming his position on the House Intelligence Committee, have spent most of their time running interference on behalf of the president. Fusion GPS, so-called investigation, is really an exercise in distraction. It's clear from reporting over the last week that Fusion GPS's research about Russian contacts was not what launched the Russia investigation within the FBI, that there were other foreign intelligence services, including the Australians, the Brits, who were presenting information that alarmed U.S. intelligence officials about Russian interference operations. There's a ton of evidence that has nothing to do with the SEAL dossier that corroborates the Russian interference operations, both at the human level and trying to turn particular people into assets for the Russians that were associated with the campaign, all the way to the troll farms and other social media platform efforts to tilt elections in various demographics. So that's all an exercise in distraction. I think Fusion GPS has been treated very badly as a matter of a congressional investigation. And let's just remember, you know, the FBI isn't the only one that we should expect even-handed administration of investigations from. We should expect that from Congress, too. Congress is a more political place, but it also ought to have some minimum standards of due process with which it treats its witnesses. And when I ran a committee that issued subpoenas and had these kinds of negotiations, we tried very hard to maintain the legitimacy of our effort by ensuring that we treated witnesses with respect, even though we were aggressive at trying to ferret out the facts. And the idea of taking testimony and then selectively leaking things to conservative political allies in order to make a public narrative when the other side can't use the parts where they explain away those transcript points is a very fundamentally unfair thing to do. That would be unfair in a grand jury. It would be unfair in a trial. And it's an unfair in Congress. So I feel for the people at Fusion GPS, and I applaud their efforts at coming forward. And I think, you know, at the appropriate time, these committees should release the full transcripts so that the American people can understand exactly what Fusion GPS's role. It may be an important role, and there may have been some information that they provided that was inaccurate, but it's certainly not the whole story, and it certainly doesn't, answer the question of why the president's senior management team agreed to meet with Russian officials on the promise of getting dirt on their opponent, or why people weren't forthcoming on their national security disclosure forms or their lobbying registration forms, or why the president was allegedly leaning on the FBI director to drop an investigation of his national security advisor related to Russia. So, you know, Fusion GPS doesn't answer any of those questions, and it's just a shiny penny that's being paraded about by Republicans. I hope that over this break, some of these Republican leaders, like Chuck Grassley, have gone home and spent some time with their families and thought about their role in history, and are going to come back with fresh eyes and undertake their responsibilities in Congress with a little bit of a different approach in 2018, but we shall see.
Well, Andy Wright, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andy Wright, who's a professor at Savannah Law School, who teaches constitutional law, criminal procedure, presidential powers, and federal criminal law. And previously, he served in the White House as associate counsel to President Barack Obama and also worked in Congress conducting oversight of U.S. national security matters. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with Pakistan's former ambassador to the U.S. about Trump's threatening tweets accusing Pakistan of giving the U.S. nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools. Tell me, who's that fool than you? Tell the truth. Who's that fool than you? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, a senior fellow and director for South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute. He served as Pakistan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2011, and is widely credited with managing a difficult partnership during a critical phase in the global war on terrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Hussein Haqqani.
Pleasure being here, Ian, as always.
Well, thank you, Ambassador. And the new year started with a tweet from Donald Trump using Twitter as a as a vehicle of foreign policy, which in itself is rather unusual. But his opening salvo in 2018 was an attack on Pakistan. What did you make of it?
Well, first of all, there are, of course, the usual reservations that almost everybody has about using Twitter as a means of communicating on foreign policy issues. That said, I think that President Trump has taken the frustration of the United States with Pakistan to a new level. In the past, President Bush, President Obama, they were all frustrated with Pakistan's lack of cooperation in dealing with the Taliban in Afghanistan and their Pakistan's continued support for the Taliban covertly. But it was but the complaints were always made in private. They were leaked to the press, but they never came on camera and said anything critical. President Trump has taken a different tack. He criticized Pakistan openly in his speech announcing his new Afghan policy last year. And then Vice President Pence said some very critical things about Pakistan in Afghanistan over Christmas. So I think that in this particular case, it's not a matter just of tweeting instinctively. I think President Trump does have a plan to try and tighten the screws on Pakistan in a way in which it hasn't been done in the past. Whether he will succeed or not will depend on a number of things, and you and I are happy to will probably be happy to discuss those.
Well, though, is that to say that there's some truth to what Trump tweeted out, that the U.S. has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools? They give safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little help, no more. So,
well, his language, as you know, is very particular and peculiar. It's not what you and I use in the world of diplomacy or what most people use in the world of diplomacy. But if we take out the hyperbole, the fact remains that what he's saying is that the United States has not got the bang for its buck, that it has given Pakistan much more assistance than it has given to many other countries in the world and has got relatively less cooperation. Pakistanis would argue that, no, we've been there for you during the Cold War. We've been there for you during the war against the Soviets, and we have also offered cooperation in the war against terror, and that's why you got many Al-Qaeda individuals, who, some of whom are currently in Guantanamo. But at the same time, it is a fact that Pakistan's definition of its own national interest, which is determined by its military and intelligence services, that is not the same, that is different from what the United States' interests are. So even during the Cold War, yes, they provided some air bases for U-2 flights over the Soviet Union, but they never provided troops for fighting communists anywhere else in the world, despite making promises. It was always a case of offering a glass half full. And the situation has become really bad in the last 16 years. After 9/11, General Musharraf, who was the dictator of Pakistan at that time, promised that he will go after terrorists inside Pakistan, but he decided that it was easier to just hand over a few Al-Qaeda figures that were in the country and not break the backbone of the terrorist infrastructure that Pakistan has created for its own advantage in the region. So what Trump is probably concerned about is that America's success in Afghanistan has been hampered by Pakistan providing a safe haven for the Taliban and their allies. And that definitely is a reality, and that is a cause for concern, and has been a cause for concern for President Bush. It was a cause for concern for President Obama. It would have been a cause for concern for a President Hillary Clinton if she had been elected.
But given that you mentioned a minute ago, Ambassador Haqqani, that a lot of contentious discussions have gone on in private between top U.S. and Pakistani officials, in these dialogues, has anybody on the U.S. side asked Pakistan to basically explain why it is playing what the UN Ambassador Nikki Haley described as a double game. There, obviously, you just mentioned that there are different sort of strategic interests that the U.S. has and Pakistan has. Is there any way to have an honest airing of that? Because my understanding is that Pakistan is extremely paranoid about India, and the idea of India being involved in Afghanistan is an anathema. So it would seem to me that there'd be a real purpose to having a frank discussion. If your strategic interests don't coalesce and align 100%, can't you work something out?
Well, Ian, I've written a whole book on it called Magnificent Delusions, the U.S.-Pakistan relationship and the history, the epic history of misunderstanding. Here's the problem. I was born in Pakistan, raised in Pakistan. I served as Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. Look, my country's leaders have had a very, in my opinion, misplaced approach to their dealings with the United States. Instead of openly saying, look, guys, we can be your allies only as far as it doesn't interfere with our competing with and fighting India, they have always focused on getting assistance. And in getting assistance, they have often not told the whole truth. Now, yes, there can be an honest discussion about Pakistan's concerns about Indian influence in Afghanistan, but that will have to be based on some facts. And Pakistan's concerns about India sometimes border on the paranoid. For example, there was a time when Pakistani officials started saying India has 14 consulates in Afghanistan from where it will destabilize us. Now, the numbers of consulates of a country in another country is a measurable fact. It is not something you just draw out of a hat. And the truth was that there were only 4 Indian consulates, which is exactly the same number as Pakistani consulates. There are no Indian troops in Afghanistan. So what is the actual concern that Pakistan has is something that American officials have repeatedly asked us. And I can tell you, as someone who represented the Pakistan government, I represented an elected civilian government, not a military government, but our military leadership has always been, shall we say, very evasive on details. It seems that the fear is more in the head than it is in reality. Does it have something to do with the fact that Pakistan has a really enlarged military compared to the size of its economic resources? Is it because we have an intelligence service that also meddles in domestic politics? Is it because, you know, we don't put almost half our school-going age children into school because we feel that we have to pay for this huge military that will save us from impending doom at the hands of India? So those are factors that do come into play in the U.S.-Pakistan relationship, in the sense that the Americans say, we understand your concerns, but we can't accept concerns that are not backed by actual facts. And there, the Pakistani-American dialogue breaks down.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Hussein Haqqani, a senior fellow and director for South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute. He serves as Pakistan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2011 and is widely credited with managing a difficult partnership during a critical phase in the global war on terrorism. And he's the author of Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. So was Ambassador Richard Holbrooke right when he first got the job under Obama? I understand that his feeling was that in order to solve the situation in Afghanistan, first the U.S. should try and broker some peace over Kashmir and bring India and Pakistan together. And I think, if my memory serves me correctly, the Indian lobby in Washington basically scuttled that idea. But was there some merit to that idea? Is that the route to peace? Is that the priority?
Look, I don't think that there is a solution. And I'm speaking as someone who represented Pakistan at that point, and I interacted with Ambassador Holbrooke a lot. And I always told him, look, what you're trying to do is just not going to happen. And here's the reason why. India has no incentive to try and solve the Kashmir dispute on Pakistan's terms. Pakistan has nurtured the grievance over Kashmir at home, but the rest of the world no longer cares about Kashmir the way it used to. When the UN first took up Kashmir, an overwhelming majority of countries said, yeah, sure, solve the problem by holding a plebiscite there. Well, the plebiscite wasn't held partly because Pakistan didn't cooperate with the UN the way it should have, partly because India didn't do it. Now, 70 years later, can you resolve a dispute that is more or less frozen? And would India unfreeze it just because the United States asks it to? What leverage does anyone have over that? My view has always been that while Kashmir is important to Pakistanis, they also need to take a realistic view of things and understand that if China can say we can wait for Taiwan for 100 years, Pakistan should also be willing to wait for as long as it takes to resolve Kashmir so that it can pay attention to its own economic development and its own stability. Unfortunately, the jihadi terrorists have become a menace for Pakistan itself. Pakistan's education and healthcare levels have fallen. And so Pakistan needs to recognize those problems and basically let Afghanistan get on with its life, let the Kashmiris get on with theirs and get on with our lives as Pakistanis. Instead, we are going to continue to try and play this game of trying to draw America into resolving our dispute with India, which basically means America should throw its weight behind Pakistan, not be an honest broker, because if it was an honest broker, the logical solution would end up being, okay, you take half, you know, something like that. And that's not what Pakistan wants. So it's more an emotional issue than a resolvable diplomatic question.
But what apparently is a real issue, and that is that there is this entity called the Pakistan Taliban, and that has threatened the state in very, very graphic and horrendous attacks, and they happen regularly. So that surely must be getting the attention of the army and the ISI. So what is their sense of, at the end of the day, my understanding is you could have reverse sanctuary where the Pakistan Taliban would be seeking sanctuary in Afghanistan. And that's a nightmare scenario.
Absolutely, and that is something Pakistan has to be cognizant of. Unfortunately, the decision of the Pakistani military so far has been to go after the Pakistani Taliban and try and fight them, and they have done it very effectively. But at the same time, not give up the advantage they have in relation to the Afghan Taliban. They still see them as an instrument of influence in the region. And basically, it's about trying to punch beyond one's weight. Pakistan no longer has the same size difference with India it once used to have. India's economy is now 20 times larger than Pakistan's rather than just 10 times larger. Their military capability is much larger. America's military capability is much larger. And so Pakistan is not going to be able to get what it wants without some level of subconventional capability, which is what they see the jihadis as. So that's exactly what's happening here. They don't want to give up on the Afghan Taliban option, even as they have Pakistani Taliban as a problem to deal with.
Well, there's an interesting article, Ambassador Haqqani, out now titled Make China Great Again, which is an analysis of Donald Trump's foreign policy when first out of the gate, of course, he canceled the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a huge gift to China. And it makes the case that China is extremely happy. And apparently some top officials in China, including top military officials, have told at party conferences, have said that Donald Trump is the greatest gift that China ever had. So if we can look into the future a little bit, is there an inevitable shift in Pakistan towards less engagement and dependence upon the U.S. given this $225 million payment that's being held up by the U.S.? And is China likely to step into the breach in the context of that idea or that observation in the article that I mentioned, that in many ways Donald Trump has weakened America and strengthened China?
Well, I mean, there's a lot being said about President Trump's foreign policy. It's only 1 year. We don't know what it's going to happen, what it's going to lead to. There are many, many areas that are of concern to many people, including the rise of China and how China might actually end up taking advantage of America, sort of ceding space, so to speak. But Pakistan is not one of those areas because, let us be honest, $225 million is not much compared to the billions and billions that were given to Pakistan in the past. China already has a $50 billion plan for infrastructure investment in Pakistan. But look, from Pakistan's point of view, there are advantages in maintaining a relationship with both China and the United States. In case of the United States, there's high-end technology, especially in military hardware that they get. There are also advantages politically. And of course, Pakistan's elite is very integrated into the West and in a partnership with the U.S. So this oversimplification that China will somehow replace the United States when Pakistan and China have already been very, very, very close allies for many, many years because of their shared concerns about India, I think is a bit of an overstatement.
But the infrastructure, particularly the rail and road routes all the way through from China to the Indian Ocean, the major port that they've invested in Pakistan, that in itself is a massive undertaking. And what are the benefits for, we can see obviously what the benefits of China are, particularly in terms of energy, but what are the benefits for Pakistan?
Well, Pakistan's military always sees everything as a zero-sum game with India. And unfortunately, many of them probably think that by bringing China to the coast of the Arabian Sea and therefore within striking distance of the Persian Gulf, they will be increasing Pakistan's leverage in the region. I am not one of those who believes in that. If anything, it will just provoke the United States into closer cooperation with India. And there's already talk about India, United States, Australia and Japan cooperating in trying to diminish China's influence in the Indian Ocean region. Look, Pakistan as a country with almost one-third of its population living below the poverty line and another one-third living just above it needs to focus inward. It's more important for Pakistan to put its out-of-school children into school, and it has one of the world's largest out-of-school children population in the world. It has a very young population. Pakistan had an advantage during the Cold War because of its geographic location. It provided an advantage to the West. They could fly U-2 spy planes out of Pakistan over the Soviet Union or even China at one point. But that advantage is gone, and I think Pakistan should not continue to think of the world only in geostrategic terms, ignoring economics, ignoring the welfare of its own people. And it should certainly not think of the world in terms of zero-sum power games with its next-door neighbor, India.
Well, Ambassador Hussain Haqqani, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure talking to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Hussain Haqqani, who's a Senior Fellow and Director for South and Central Asia at the Hudson Institute. He served as Pakistan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2011 and is widely credited with managing a difficult partnership during a critical phase in the global war on terrorism. And he is the author of Magnificent Delusions, Pakistan, the United States, and an Epic History of Misunderstanding. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.